listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, there's a lot going on and a lot we're going to be getting to today. Congress may be on the verge of passing Fast Track, which would pave the way for the TPP, and just kind of sliding it through over the next week. I'll be sharing information about that with you. Rand Paul has weighed in with probably the stupidest argument I've ever heard against unemployment insurance lasting more than 4 weeks. I mean, it's like breathtakingly stupid. And it's I'm going to have to play that for you. It's incredible. I want to get into Norman Angell's brilliant book, The Great Illusion, a study of the relation of military power to national advantage, which predicts it's impossible that there could be a world war now because trade is so interdependent. This book, by the way, was published in 1913 and is being quoted in the Financial Times today in an article titled China Must Not Copy the Kaiser's Errors. I got to share that with you. Why is it the AAA grade bonds are no longer relevant? Well, could that mean that we're about to see that we're in the midst of another bubble that's about to burst? I mean, there's just lots and lots of stuff. The Koch brothers funded Freedom Works is now talking about, basically ending the Republican Party or shutting down the mainstream Republican Party and taking it over altogether, which is something that we've been talking about in this program for a couple of years. And this is a strategy that was laid out, the Concord documents, all these kind of things. What about and what about these guys who say they know that being gay is a choice? I've got an incredible insight into that kind of mentality. Plus, Boeing now is, well, they're going to be totally screwing their employees. And I got to share that with you. So there's an awful lot. Plus, we've got a couple of guests we're going to get into today. It's going to be an interesting day. It's going to be, what can I say beyond that? It's going to be an interesting day. And where do my one sheet go? Here we go. Yeah, in fact, in our third hour, Professor Harvey Kay is going to be with us, one of the best historians in the United States. Right now, Niall Gardner is on the line with us. Dr. Niall Gardner, foreign affairs analyst, British conservative commentator, director of the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom of the Heritage Foundation, co-author, along with Stephen Thompson, of the new book, Margaret Thatcher on Leadership, Lessons for American Conservatives Today. Niall, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me on the show, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Margaret Thatcher, I mean, she saw her policies cause unemployment to rise up to 12% in 1984. It was the highest since the 1930s. When she put the poll tax into place, which was basically a flat tax that every single household in the UK had to pay, it caused riots. The industrial north was wiped out by Thatcherism, I mean, forever, essentially. Why? And the conservatives never pulled more than 43% of the popular vote during her entire leadership. Why would that be a formula for anybody to emulate?
Well, Tom, you know, Margaret Thatcher really rescued Britain from being a complete basket case in the 1970s, turning the UK into one of the most dynamic economies in the world. In fact, the most dynamic economy in Europe. Britain really was literally on its hands and knees in the 1970s after decades of socialism, socialist-style big government policies. And she firmly believed that British decline could be reversed. And she set about doing that principally by getting government.
What kind of metric are you using to suggest that Britain was on its hands and knees?
Well,
I mean, I spent a fair amount of time in Great Britain in the 70s. It seemed like things were going quite well. They were, I mean, you know, there was that unwinding of the Bretton Woods Accord that happened in 71 in the United States, I think 73 in the UK when you guys went off the gold standard altogether and we did too. And there was this effort to use monetary policy to drive trade policy, which didn't seem to work out all that well.
Well, Tom, I think that, you know, when a great country like Britain, I do believe Britain is a truly great nation, you know, has to go to the IMF for a loan.
But they had to go to the IMF to get dollars because because Great Britain had changed from using gold as the standard for international currency swaps, basically, for purposes of trade, to using dollars, and they just didn't have enough dollars. That doesn't mean that the country was on its hands and knees.
Yeah, Tom, it's really about building up, levels of debt that simply couldn't be paid for. And as Margaret Thatcher, you know, famously said, you know, the problem with socialist governments is that eventually they'd run out of other people's money to spend. And that was exactly the situation in Britain. It was really, you know, humiliating.
But it was not. I mean, that IMF loan was not for debt. That IMF loan was to cover balance of payments, unless you're calling international trade debt.
Well, it was really to keep the British economy afloat. I mean, I think there was a real air of desperation.
In the context of international trade.
I think it's a lot more than that, Tom. And, you know, at the end of the day, Britain was in a humiliating position. It really was, I mean, literally, the sick man of Europe. It was a nation that, frankly, was suffocating under, I think, you know, decades of big government that had been implemented not just by the Labour Party, but also by the conservatives as well.
Okay, so yeah. Thatcher sold off, what, 50 major industries that were government-owned?
Well, certainly she sold off a large number of industries. I don't know about 50 exactly.
Yeah, but a large chunk of, you know, the British economy was government-owned and government-run, which you could do, and I think probably correctly you could describe as bloated and inefficient, and many Brits at the time would, but... you know, it's sort of like Ronald Reagan. You know, he tripled the national debt in the United States. And I, you know, my response to that was, give me a $3 trillion credit card and I'll show you what, you know, it looks like to have a good time. It makes the economy look good. But after you've sold off all of the national industries, what do you do for an encore?
Well, you know, that was just one aspect. Privatization, of course, was a key aspect of Thatcherism. And let's not forget that, you know, Margaret Thatcher won 3 general elections in a row. Of course, a 3-party system. So you mentioned the 43% figure, but
right.
You have to remember that you have both the Labour and the Liberal parties vying for office.
Right.
She was a big believer, of course,
and the Tories.
In enabling people to buy their own homes. So she sold off millions of council houses.
Right, and government-owned housing stock, basically.
Yeah, would be called public housing in America. And millions of those who are able to buy their own homes then supported Margaret Thatcher's sort of, you know, conservative revolution in the United Kingdom. They at last had a real stake in society. There was a reason for her success. I think she was able to reach out to ordinary people in Britain. Margaret Thatcher herself came from a very humble background. She was a grocer's daughter. She spent over a decade working in her father's grocer's shop. She was not someone who came from the sort of traditional, you know, upper class elites of the Conservative Party. I think she had a
but
real,
there
a
is
real
no longer there is no longer housing stock to sell off. There is no longer railroads to sell off. There is no longer, you know, I mean, what are the lessons for today out of that?
Well, I think there are, of course, you know,
we have just a minute left here.
There are more houses to sell. But I think that, you know, if you look at I'm Britain today, one of the most successful economies in Europe. A totally different story to the sense of despair and desperation that was around in Britain in the 1970s. I do think the foundations have been laid by Margaret Thatcher for long-term prosperity in Britain.
You mean like deregulation of the banking industry?
Well, but based upon the principles of economic freedom, really, and giving everyone an opportunity to move up the social ladder, which I think she strongly believed in.
But social mobility is lower now than it was in 1975.
I don't think that's the UK. Case at all. I do think, you know, in Britain... You know, you can really succeed provided you're willing to work hard and do well. I do think Britain, like America, is a tremendous land of opportunity.
The United States has become one of the most least socially mobile countries in the OECD. I thought the UK was, you know, 3, 4, or 5 points below us, but
I think, you know, Britain and America both truly great nations.
Okay.
Niall
Gardner is the author of the new book. Margaret Thatcher on Leadership, Lessons for American Conservatives Today, along with Stephen Thompson. Niall, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks very much, Tom. A real pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Good speaking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Margaret Thatcher on Leadership. Interesting. Kind of like Ronald Reagan on Leadership. Welcome back. Andrew Campbell is on the line with us. With a senior producer with The Big Picture. And, hey, Dylan, Niall is on line 12. Please pick him up and thank him. Hey, Andrew, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good. Let's get into the TV show tonight. Here we go. Oh, we're going to start with the third way. That looks like fun.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about comments that the co-founder of Third Way made. And basically, Jim Kessler, the co-founder, wrote an op-ed criticizing Elizabeth Warren. And we're going to get into really why he's criticizing her and what that says about the overall sentiment towards the possibility of Warren running for president. And we'll also use it as a segue to talk about lowering the national retirement age to 55 to save the economy. We're going to have Jack Berkman on. He's a GOP strategist to talk about that and debate the issue. And he has a pretty strong take about it, so it should be interesting.
It should be. And then in the second block, the WTO.
Yeah, the WTO has announced even cheaper labor countries can now compete with us. And it's just really perpetuating this whole notion of a race to the bottom. And the idea that corporations now rule really the entire world and basically can do whatever they want and get away with it. We're going to possibly have Lori Wallach on from Public Citizens Global Trade Watch to talk about it. And we might even get into news on the TPP that's coming out today, too.
Okay. That would be very, very good. And then Austin Peterson is going to come by and defend cutting off unemployment benefits to people.
Yeah, Rand Paul came out with some interesting comments. He said that he only supports unemployment benefits for workers up to 26 weeks, but he doesn't support anything more than that because he says that the more people are unemployed, the longer they're unemployed, the less likely they are to find jobs.
In other words, he's saying that the reason why people stay unemployed is because there are unemployment benefits available to them.
Yeah, just reap the rewards of the government. And as everyone knows, that's the real conservative meme, that people are living comfy lives off of government aid, when that's not the case, as we all know.
That's stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, that is like so out of touch.
Yeah, I think stupid is the only way to sum up those comments.
Yeah, okay. Best of the rest of the news.
Best of the rest. We're going to be talking to filmmakers Harry and Joe Gantz. They've produced a new HBO documentary called American Winter, which takes a look at families struggling with poverty in your one of your recent hometowns of Portland, Oregon. And it's a really good snapshot of how Americans are struggling to recover from the Great Recession and really how devastating poverty can be and what needs to be done about it.
Yeah, okay. And I'm really looking forward to this in Block D. The Satanists are just okay. They're just very, very happy, the Satan worshipers. Very happy with the, you know, what's going on in Oklahoma.
Yeah, as a lot of people know, in Oklahoma there is a large statue of the Ten Commandments outside of the Oklahoma State House, and a group of Satanists from the Satanic Temple of New York says, well, if there can be a statue of the Ten Commandments, there can be a statue of Satan. So they have said they are willing to donate a statue to put outside the Oklahoma State House. And it's an interesting double standard that they're trying to point out, that right. If religious conservatives can have a say, so can other groups of
right.
religious.
And they don't want it to be a statue of Satan. They want it to be the upside-down five-pointed star, the pentagram.
Yeah, there's multiple options.
Yeah, so you know, we have to point out to them that they've actually already won that war, that the Republican Party has put that on their logo. So that should be a good one. Okay, Andrew Campbell, thank you. Oh, and then, of course, our daily take. We're gonna get into this. It's going to be put United back in the United States.
Yep.
Andrew, thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. So Maggie Thatcher was a great leader because she sold off the national industries and she gave people the houses that they were renting, and they liked her for that. Except that unemployment went up to 12%, and well, anyway, what can you say? Suicides, in fact, went up, even. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. What's that, Shane? Here. Let me hand it over here. Anyhow, welcome back. Thank you. Oh, UK national debt as a percentage of GDP. Oh, isn't this nice? Yeah, it was not a debt problem. The national debt in the United Kingdom as a percentage of GDP in the 70s and 80s was continuously, actually it was fairly level through the Thatcher years. It declined in the 90s, and it started going back up again in 2012. It's high. It's twice as high now as it was during the Thatcher years, so that's interesting. And social mobility is among the worst in the developed world because children from poor backgrounds are less likely to get a good education. This is the Mail Online about the United Kingdom. Okay, so my point was right. Anyhow, some of the other things that I mentioned to you, thank you for that, Shano, some of the other things that I mentioned to you before we got started that I wanted to get to. Oh, and also, you know, the main thing that made the United Kingdom no longer the sick man of Europe. And I can't, I'm astounded. I forgot to mention this to our guest is to Mr. Gardner. Is that they discovered oil in the North Sea. And they started pumping that stuff out during Thatcher's time. And the UK suddenly got rich. They suddenly became a major oil exporting country. And, you know, British Petroleum, right? BP. Anyhow. Boeing. This is mind-boggling. First, Boeing goes to the state of Washington and says, give us billions of dollars in tax cuts. The state of Washington says, okay, fine, here you go. You know, just keep your jobs here. Just keep doing the good old work. Then Boeing goes to their workers and says, you guys take a cut in your pensions. We're going to convert your pensions to 401ks. And, you know, we're basically, you know, so what? You got a seven-year contract. We're going to, you know, screw the contract. Please sign this form that says that you accept the changes to your contract. Workers held a vote. Only about 40% of them said yes. The majority said no. And so as soon as that vote happened, this is the great American corporate bootlicking. Mark Sumner wrote a great piece about this over at Daily Kos over the weekend. And so, you know, Alabama gets into it, but Missouri is the, you know, Governor Jay Nixon, I mean, apparently without even being asked, convened a special legislative session and got all the Republicans in Missouri to say, let's offer $1.7 billion to Boeing if they'll come here. Where are we going to get that 1.7? Well, we'll borrow some of it. We'll cut low-income housing. We'll find ways to screw poor people. $1.7 billion? Amazing. This same governor, by the way, chopped $400 million out of next year's budget before he offered this 1.7, saying, oh, we're spending too much, we're spending too much. Oh, by the way, here, Boeing, you want $1.7 billion? The Senate vote, I'm not sure the source of this, but basically, the existing tax credits for developers, low-income housing, and historic building. We're going to cut this stuff to pay for this. You know, this should be, by the way, Boeing's profits are at an all-time high. Its CEO pay is at an all-time high. This kind of stuff should be criminalized. Not criminalized. It should be discouraged. And it should be discouraged the way that Bernie Sanders recommended on this program years ago. In fact, I believe he proposed legislation to this effect back when he was in the House of Representatives, that any state that offers a corporation that is already headquartered in or working in another state, any state that offers an incentive like tax breaks for a company to move from state to state within the United States should lose their federal highway funds. Let's just put an end to this. This is insane. I had this incredible epiphany over the weekend. Those of you who have listened to the program for years and years, I mean, gay marriage has become so almost routine now. There's still a long way to go, obviously, here in the United States. But the debate has just kind of died. But back 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago on this program, I was regularly getting these right-wingers who were coming on who were saying things like, this.
A homosexual exercises any sort of selectivity at all when it comes to intimate matters. He is proving that it's a matter of choice.
Right. That being gay is a matter of choice. And I would get these guys on and, you know, so often they were kind of Rick Santorum-ish in their whatever. My gaydar went off, let's say. What's Michelle Bachmann's husband's name? Marcus Bachmann-ish. And So there was this piece in the New York Times Sunday magazine over the weekend written by Seth Stevens Davidowitz asking, you know, how many gay guys are still in the closet nationwide and where? And he could, and what he did is, you know, on Facebook, you can say who you're most interested in. And there are other places where you can just, well, actually, there's a whole bunch of metrics. Well, there's a huge aha here. Anyway, and right after the break, I'm going to share that with you. Because it just like all of a sudden, all kinds of stuff fell into place for me. I'll share that with you right after this break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be right back with that. And why are we radicals at heart here? So, anyway, I had this epiphany over the weekend reading this article in the New York Times, and it was just like one of these forehead slaps, and it was like, how could I have missed this for all these years? And why didn't any of my gay friends ever point this out to me? I mean, literally, how could I have missed this? First, this fellow did this survey, and he found that he's estimating that about 5% of American men are gay, okay? And on Facebook, you can say what gender you're interested in. So you can say, I'm a man and I'm interested in men, or I'm a man and I'm interested in women. So you can, you know, be out or not. And what he found was that in the red states, in the states that are hostile to being gay, where they don't have gay marriage and things like that, it was around 1%, whereas in California, it was around 3%. States where you had gay marriage that were not hostile to gays, around 3%. So there's more guys in the closet in the red states, number one. And he had a whole bunch of different, you know, Craigslist ads, all kinds of stuff. The casual encounters, actually the highest percentages of ads on Craigslist looking for gay casual encounters are in Kentucky, Louisiana, and Alabama. Because those guys are, you know, they're deeper in the closet, so they're more likely to use Craigslist. So anyhow, he says, but sometimes even I get tired of looking at aggregate data. This is Seth Stevens Davidowitz. So I asked a psychiatrist in Mississippi who specializes in helping closeted gay men if any of his patients might want to talk to me. One man contacted me. This guy was in his 60s. He's a retired professor. He's been married to the same woman for 40 years. In other words, he looks to the rest of the world like a straight man. And he had only about 10 years ago in his 50s come to his therapist and finally basically admitted to anybody that he was attracted to men. Now, here's the sentence that just knocked me over. He has always known he was attracted to men, he says, but thought that that was normal and something that men hid. Now, let that settle in for a minute. You're born gay. You're attracted to men. Everybody tells you it's evil, it's wrong, don't do it, blah, blah, blah. Now, we all tend to judge others by ourselves. So I suddenly had the answer of why these people would come on my radio program, men who claimed that they were straight. And in the case of some of them who were even married and had been for years, one of them brought his wife with him, fellow in his 60s. His wife was in her 60s. One of the leaders of the anti-gay movement. Come on this radio program and insist that being gay was a choice. And I'm sitting here going, I was born knowing that I was interested in girls, not boys. How could anybody not know that? And when I read this sentence, he had always known that he was attracted to men, he says, but thought that that was normal and something that other men hid. Suddenly the penny dropped for me. These guys are all gay. and they're judging the rest of the world by themselves. And they think that they have made the moral judgment, and they're assuming that I have, you know, talking to me, I'm, you know, ostensibly straight, and I'm married, and I've got kids and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I must be hiding or fighting my desires too, right? I mean, literally, and in fact, it's interesting because on a couple of occasions in having these debates with these guys who are, you know, against gay marriage and you know, homosexuality is an evil thing and it's a choice. When they come on my program, occasionally they've been on the program in my physical presence, and more than once I've gotten the vibe that it's almost like a flirt vibe. And it just suddenly hit me. These guys are all gay, and they think that every man has this. They think that every man feels the way they do. They're judging the world by themselves. And it just hit me what a horrible tragedy this is. And how many generations this has been going on, that these gay men, you know, they're born gay and they have to literally spend their entire lives living a lie, fighting the impulse, because it's the right thing to do. In fact, if you Google, is my husband, and, you know, the autofill in Google, the most common next word is not, is my husband having an affair, which you would think. The most common next word is gay. And you see those searches in particular in the red states. Because these are women who have married guys who really are gay, but they are not acknowledging it to their wives, they're not acknowledging it to themselves, and they're not acting out on it. They're just swallowing it, to mangle a metaphor. They're just saying, that's it. I'm, you know, denying it. Living a life denial. I'm curious what you think of my my startling revelation. It is startling to me. He's estimating 5% of American men are gay. In the gay-friendly states, about 3% of American men appear to be out, which means that 2% or two-fifths, 4 out of every 10, 40 out of every 100, 4 million out of every 10 million gay men are living fully embedded in the closet. In the gay-friendly states. And in the gay-hostile states, it's 4 out of 5. You know, 80 out of 100. 8 million out of 10 million. Living fully in the closet. And in incredible pain, I would think. And in fact, Seth Stevens Davidowitz ends his article. He says, he and his wife do not have sex. He says that he would feel guilty ever ending his marriage or openly dating a man. He's talking about this professor who is attracted to men but got married 40 years ago and has lived with the same woman for 40 years. He said he and his wife do not have sex. He says that he would feel guilty ever ending his marriage or openly dating a man. He regrets virtually every one of his major life decisions. Can you imagine that in your 60s looking back? What our society has done to gay people? I mean, it's enough to make you want to cry. It's just the and we're just kind of sort of waking up from it. And it's interesting because, you know, Louise and I had this conversation with a fellow from another country last week who was from a country that's relatively hostile to gays. And he was going, you know, what's this, you know, this gay marriage thing? I said, you know, I don't get this. Whoops. Somehow. There we go. He says, I don't, you know, this gay marriage thing, I don't get this, you know, what's going on in the United States. You know, are you saying that that's okay? Is it okay to have sex with animals or kids or, you know, and I'm like, what? These are old arguments. This is stupid stuff. I mean, that's, He's like, well, isn't it a choice? I mean, we had this conversation before I read this piece, and now I'm looking back on it going, I'll bet he's one of those guys. He's single in his 30s. I'm like, wow, what is, you know, what a sad thing that people can't be who they are. So anyhow, we have, you know, Boeing screwing their workers. Oh, the great illusion. I was going to get to that. I may have to do this. I think I'm going to do this in the second hour because I do want to take some phone calls. In fact, let's just do that right now. John in Sebring, Florida. Hey, John, thanks for calling. What's up?
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Thank you. The
and
same to you.
Good Thanksgiving, because it's tough to get through. I might not get through.
Okay.
I told my brother. My brother said, oh, homosexuality is a choice. I said, well, why don't you choose it? Go to the porno shop and get some gay porn and see if it arouses you. And he was like, what? What? I got no answer for that. But here, I figured out why homosexuality exists. Number one, it's part of God's plan. Number two, God made a mistake. Number three, God was asleep at the switch. Number four, there is no God. In any one of those four.
Or number five, if there is a God, however you conceive of him, her, or them, or it, God has no role in determining somebody's sexuality.
Well, anyway, no matter which one of those four you pick, there's no reason for us to beat up on gays. And
yeah.
Furthermore, what about hermaphrodites? They can't marry a woman because they're part woman. They can't marry a man because they're part man. And if they marry another hermaphrodite, that's a same-sex marriage.
Wow. I don't know how to answer that one, John. I frankly don't know enough about hermaphrodites. But I got it. I just find this whole thing interesting and amazing and tragic. And it adds to my conviction that we've got to do something.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We need to move even faster in the United States towards absolute equality for gay people right across this country, in every single state, in every single county, in every way. Now, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Catherine watching Free Speech TV in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Catherine, what's on your mind today?
Well, I've got three bits of information. One's about the TPP.
Mm-hmm.
There's a website called The Verge, and they had an article on November 13th, 2013, about the papers that were leaked this summer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a link. A link to the wiki page, and you can PDF the whole thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it to my state rep, who's a lawyer, because I tried to go through it a little bit, and it is kind
of... I spent about a half hour this morning reading some of those leaked documents. Some were actually given to the Huffington Post also, independent of WikiLeaks. Apparently, somebody from one of the other countries involved has given some to the Huffington Post, and they had some up this morning, and I was reading those. They're fairly heavily redacted, actually.
But
I couldn't, you know, it was obvious that they're up to something, but, you know, it's pretty dense
redacted
stuff. Yeah, I know. I looked at the WikiLeaks stuff last week.
Oh, okay. And the other thing I wanted to say was, you know, when we were talking about the speculation on the renter's leases, I heard about that a year and a half ago, but I wasn't able to vet it back then.
The renter's leases, what?
The renter's leases and the speculation on it of the banksters that are buying up rentals.
Oh, the banksters who are buying houses right now in order to rent them out to people,
right.
and then they're securitizing the rent payments the way that they used to securitize mortgage payments.
Well, there's another setup that goes with that in our state, and probably in any other state where there's a Republican governor. They've taken away all renters' rights. So you could come home and there could be nothing there, and they've got all your money and they've got all your stuff.
Right. So if you're one day, you know, when I first read that article, there was a brief mention about how one of these companies had this policy of if you were one day late on your rent, they would proceed with an eviction, a physical eviction the next day. And
yeah.
I thought, how can they do that? And apparently,
well,
in some states, that's legal. It's possible.
Right. They've taken away the rights, either wholly or in part. One of the things that they can do is some places, they tried to pass it here that on a neighbor's hearsay, they could just put you out.
Wow.
And it goes on and on and on and on, depending on what rights they've taken away from you.
Right. So in Wisconsin, really, under the Scott Walker administration, have they expanded landlord rights?
Yes. Last year they took away renter's rights, and this year they took a whole nother set away.
Wow.
And the one of the state reps who was a gift to, because he owns 141 properties, put out 17 families the next week. See, the thing that's also gone is they can ask for 2 months' rent, last month, and security. And the minute they put you out, they get to keep all that.
Wow. So they've got a third of a year, basically.
Yeah, I'm figuring people are probably going to do 3 or 4. They're probably going to ask them for first, last, and a deposit. So
right,
they're probably going to lose at least 2 months. And if they put them out in the middle of a month, they'll lose that month. So
right,
it's going to make it absolutely impossible for people.
Incredible. We're sliding into this Dickensian world. It's like Dickens England all over again.
And there's one other thing. I don't know if you've talked about this.
Yeah.
It was back in August. A scientist came out with saying that down in the Gulf Coast on the beaches,
mm-hmm,
those tar balls have flesh-eating bacteria in them, and not to touch them.
MRSA?
Yes.
Oh, my. Oh, my. No, I missed that. Catherine, thank you for the call. Thank you for watching Free Speech TV, and thank you for your contributions to our program. They are very useful. I appreciate the call. Thank you. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you 10 minutes before the hour. Mary in Little Mountain, South Carolina. Hey, Mary, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. I was very interested about your talking about the gays. Back in the mid-60s, I was dating my husband, who is now my ex-husband, and he was living with this man who was openly gay, and his excuse was that he was living with him because he couldn't afford to pay, you know, a place of his own.
Mm-hmm.
And he even told me of times where this man would attack him, like at night, like just jump on him, and he said he'd have to fight him off and all that. And I've always wondered if he was maybe bisexual, because I remember when we finally got married, because we had dated for 2 years, this man came to me and said, "You won."
Huh. That asks, you know, the question, what does bisexual mean? Because my experience, and you know, in every man I've ever known, I've never known a genuinely bisexual man. All I've known are gay men who live with or have sex with women to cover up the fact that they're gay, if that makes sense.
Yes, so perhaps he was just kind of covering up that he really was gay too.
Yeah, and you were his cover for a while, as it were.
For 30 years.
Wow. Is he still alive?
Yes. And now he is living with another woman. They're not married, because we've been divorced for 14 years.
Right.
But he's always, talked down about the gays and everything. But I truly believe that.
See,
I think he was denying that he was gay.
Yeah, I'm increasingly convinced too of homophobes are probably men who are born gay, who think that every other man is just like them, and that all the rest of us are just denying the impulse, and the openly gay guys are the ones who are giving into the impulse, and how can they be so immoral, that sort of thing. And it makes perfect sense. Mary, thank you for sharing that story with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks for calling in. That's Greg in La Follette, Tennessee. How do you say it, Greg?
Yeah, it's actually La Follette.
So what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to say I just recently became aware of your television, as I watch very little TV, and it's awesome. I'm like, you know, holy crap, this is on TV.
Thank you.
Thinkers are amazing, and as many do, I'm so prone to digression, so I'm going to try to make a point without going 18 different places at one time. But what that woman just said, to chime in, I just want to make two brief points. Yes, there is no such thing. Thank you so much, Tom Hartman, to tell the world there is no such thing as bisexuality.
At least in men. I mean, there's some evidence that women's sexuality can be more fluid than men, but I don't.
Thank you. But I am convinced latent, and you know, the latent homosexuality, it's latent life. Well, people wake up, he's finally admitting at 57 years old that he's gay.
Right.
They think it's some environmental thing. We seem to, as a society, oh, he's finally he's listened to too many Boy George records.
Yeah, or somebody converted him, you know?
Yeah, right, exactly. He's finally given in to this, the devil, the devil, you know,
right.
Living in
right.
The, not necessarily, I hate my sarcasm, but the enlightened capital of the world.
Right.
You know, I might get strung up for this telephone call if anybody knows if they hear it. But anyway, you know, it's insane. We are so blind in respect of feminine, the other gender, lesbianism, homosexuality. My stepson just came home devastated the other day because his bisexual girlfriend broke up with him. And I said, Jonathan, don't you understand? She didn't break up with Jonathan. She broke up with your gender, man. It's like, you're not getting you're not seeing that bisexuality is a fence-walking cop-out. You're either pregnant or you're not. You know, she finally decided, like you used the term, the cover. She finally went home. She finally said, you know, it's that simple. And he looked at me, this 19-year-old boy, and said, or man, whatever, tried to look at me and understand that. And some lights went on. So he took this. It was like nobody'd ever suggested that to him.
Yeah.
In this lightened age, supposedly, we live in, it's absolutely mind-boggling. And I just wanted to say, too, I'll stay on point. I was going to make 18. The people that we wiped out, my ancestors, my Puritan ancestry that came here and decided to go west and saw these heathens that happened to live out there and said, you know, basically, you either take Jesus Christ as your personal savior or it's open season. And the saddest irony of our history, my heritage is that they had so much to teach us.
Yeah. Including being tolerant of gays. I'm with you. Greg, I got to move along, but thank you for your call, and thanks for your spot-on comments. Judy in Northampton, Mass., listening to WHMP. Hey, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Good. I got excited when I heard you starting to talk about this gay thing. I think that realization you had is a genius, you know, genius, and wonderful to understand that. Also, I've been developing my own theories about this and that, and one thing I've been working on recently is realizing that when our ancestors, our very distant ancestors, started developing, evolving from just beasts, you know, regular animals, into primates and then human beings, we had these genes that taught us how to, you know, what to do next and, you know, how to take care of your babies and what to eat and stuff. We had that in our genes. But then we started having free will and being able to think for ourselves, and so we could have the genetic predispositions to do this or that, but then we could decide not to do that. We could do what we wanted.
Right.
So then where's morality come from? So I think that morality was brought along in the form of religion, and that's where morality...
Except that morality precedes religion, Judy. When you look at organizations, if you look at indigenous societies, well, they have their own religions, but morality is fairly universal. Religion really varies wildly from area to area. I think that religion reflects morality rather than the other way around. But thank you for your call. I respectfully, we'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. I think we need to stick our clock in the window over the weekend. One of those clocks that's supposed to sync to atomic time, but it's telling me it's a minute and a half earlier than it is, or later, I guess, would be. In any case, well, I'm here. You're here. So, we can continue this conversation about this insight that I had. And I think that I think that this is the kind of thing that these poor gay guys who think that every man is born with gay impulses and don't get it that no, you're gay. It's like, and so then they run around trashing everybody who does act on those impulses because they've been able to not do so. Most of the time. Ted Haggard. Right. So, or whatever. I mean, fill in the blanks. But there were a couple of other things I told you I wanted to talk about. One of those was the Great Illusion. And so, let me get through this rant, and then I'll pick up your phone calls on, because there's a whole bunch of people who wanted to talk about sexuality here. And we'll get to that. But I think this is a big deal. In my book, The Crash of 2016, and no, this is not a gratuitous plug for the book. In fact, this is the scary thing. I tried to really downplay this in the book. One of the things that we observed was that there are these 80-year cycles of crashes followed by wars. 80 years ago was the crash of 1929 followed by World War II. 80 years before that was the crash of 1857 followed by the Civil War. 80 years before that was the crash of 1769, 1770 followed by the American Revolution. And 80 years before that there was, we have a crash. It takes us a decade or two to figure out how to put things back together. Then things are stable for 50 or 60 years. And then, the people who remember how the crash happened and how we put it back together die off. And so we get stupid, and they make the same stupid mistakes. Reagan dropped taxes in 1984, 85, and 86, the exact same way that Warren Harding dropped them in 1921. And so we get stupid again, we make the same stupid mistakes, and we end up with the same result, and we have another crash, followed by a war. And I suggest in the book, The Crash of 2016, hopefully we'll avoid the war part this time. That we've at least figured that out. But if we don't, there's a couple possible scenarios for war. And one of them would involve China versus Taiwan and Japan. And keep in mind, I wrote this a year ago. So now, here it is. In the Financial Times, I read this article, and it just dropped my jaw. Martin Wolf over on the, I think this was in the Lex column. No, it wasn't. This is in the Financial Times, FT.com. The headline, China Must Not Copy the Kaiser's Errors. The subhead, Beijing and its dispute with Japan, risks repeating the errors of an earlier era that led to war. And he talks about, the arrival of Imperial Germany in the late 19th century. And back then, there was the question raised, is this a problem, the militarization of Germany? He says, we know how this story ended in 1914. 1914, of course, being the year that World War I started, when Archduke Ferdinand in July of 1914 was assassinated in Sarajevo and the dominoes started to fall. And it resolved itself on November 11th, 1918, with the end of World War I, and then a year later, the Treaty of Versailles. And he points to this book, The Great Illusion. Martin Wolf references this, and I love reading these old books. And so I spent a good part of yesterday, when I was supposed to be writing my own next book, reading The Great Illusion by Norman Angell. It was originally published in 1909. The copy that I have in my hand was printed in 1913. It's actually a PDF of the copy that was printed in 1913, fourth revised and enlarged edition. Of course, this was a year before World War I. And in this book, and it was published by G.P. Putnam's and Sons. And it lays out this doctrine. Now, keep in mind, this was before World War I. And it says, you know, what are the fundamental motives that explain the present rivalry of armaments in Europe, notably the Anglo-German? In other words, there's this arms race going on in 1909 between Germany and England. And people were starting to worry. And so this fellow Angell comes along, Norman Angell, and he says, don't worry about this. He says, this is not going to lead to war. There's no way. He said, you know, war belongs to a stage of development out of which we have passed. The commerce and industry of the people no longer depend upon the expansion of its political frontiers. In fact, I'm quoting now from the book, the military power is socially and economically futile and can have no relation to the prosperity of the people exercising it. And in that, he was right, by the way. World War I, nobody won. At the end of World War I, everybody was more impoverished by it. That it is impossible for one nation to seize by force the wealth of or trade of another, to enrich itself by subjugating or imposing by will its will by force on another. He was right. Again, you know, no winners in World War I economically. He says, in short, war, even when victorious, can no longer achieve those aims for which people strive. I'm quoting. 1913, wealth in the economically civilized world is founded upon credit and commercial contract. When Germany annexed Alsatia, no individual German has secured a single mark's worth of Alsatian property as the spoils of war. Just the border went back and forth, right? Alsace-Lorraine, you know, it went back and forth between the Germans and the French over and over and over again. He says, international finance has become so interdependent and so interwoven with trade and industry that the intangibility of an enemy's property extends to his trade. Therefore, political and military power can in reality do nothing for trade. So therefore, end of quote. Therefore, there's not going to be a war. Come on, give me a break. He says, the forces which have brought about the economic futility of military power have also rendered it futile as a means of enforcing a nation's moral ideals, which is the other argument for war. Oh, those people are bad. Or imposing social institutions upon a conquered people. Germany cannot turn Canada or Australia into German colonies, that is, stamp out their language or their law or their literature or their tradition by capturing them. The fight for ideals can no longer take the form of a fight between nations. War has no longer the justification that it makes for the survival of the fittest. So anyhow, all that is a quote from this book that was published in 1913 saying, you know, there's this arms race going on between Germany and England, and don't worry about it because war is impossible. Well, right now there's an arms race going on between Japan and China and Taiwan and the United States. And what Martin Wolf is pointing out in the Financial Times is, you know, he's talking about this East China Sea Air Defense Identification Zone, where now the Chinese, the South Koreans, and the Japanese are all basically claiming the same reef. And he says, national ambition, this is how he ends the article. Nationalist ambitions and resentments over past wrongs are all too human, but this game is just too risky. For the sake of the longer-term interests of the Chinese people, Mr. Xi should think again and halt. Because he's basically saying this could lead to World War III. So those of you who remember in 2006, when I was saying, look at the housing starts, there's going to be a stock market crash within a year or so. Look out. Let's have this conversation in a year or two about the war.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And please, God, let me be wrong, because a war between the United States and China, or Japan and China, and of course with Japan it would involve the United States, would be horrible. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey.
My original call is about not about Social Security, it's about unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
I have two alternatives, my first and second choice. But real quickly, I want to say that when President Bill Clinton declared at some time during his first administration, I believe, that we would no longer see world wars, I laughed at that. In the same way I laughed at that white male caller about 10 minutes to the hour who declared that there's no such thing as bisexuality. I can tell him from personal experience that there is such a thing without getting into detail, because it would take too long to get into all the nuances of sexuality and identity and gender and all that other stuff.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So are you still with me?
I am. I'm still with you.
Still with me?
Yes. I'm still with you.
Hello.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Hello.
Hello, Johnny. We're talking.
There?
Johnny, can you hear me? Johnny can't hear me. Is that odd? Johnny, if you can't hear me, let me put you on hold for a minute. Johnny, maybe can you hear me on hold? Now I'm going to put you back on again. Johnny, could you hear me when you were on hold? Johnny can't hear anything. Okay. Johnny, call back. Hopefully we don't have a problem with our phone system. We reset the thing at the beginning of the hour. Kevin in Merida, California. Kevin, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So what's up, Kevin?
I was on the gay subject also. The thing is that gay is a choice. And
how do you know that?
With people, because the argument is always, their favorite argument is, I was born this way, and why do I have these feelings?
Right.
Well, for one, the reason why you have these feelings is because we were born with two hormones. One is a male hormone, and the other is the female hormone. But mm-hmm.
So, Kevin, have you made a choice to be straight or to be gay?
Oh, I've always known I was excuse. I've always known I was straight, and that's how I was raised to be.
So how? If you've always known that you were straight, could you choose to be gay?
Yeah, I could choose to be gay.
You really think so?
That'd be a lifestyle that I want to live.
So you can imagine having sex with a man, living with a man for the rest of your life, having sex regularly, and finding that as a pleasant and pleasurable thing. You can imagine that.
No, I couldn't imagine it. No, I couldn't imagine.
Okay, if you can't imagine that, how can you say that it's a choice?
Because there's a choice that you make in your life, whether you want to do it or not. People want to experiment with certain things they want to do anyway.
Yeah.
So they make a choice to either not do that or make a choice to do it.
But there's a difference between experimenting. I mean, when I was a teenager, I had sex with a man. I tried it out. I discovered I don't like this. I mean, you know.
That was a choice you made, right?
No, it wasn't. To try it was a choice. Yeah, but you know, but I wasn't, you know, trying to figure out if I was gay or straight. I was a teenager and I was experimenting. I experimented with a lot of things, you know, that, drugs. I mean, you know, lots of stuff. But the point is that I'm straight and I know it. And there was no, I just don't think that gay people are straight people like you and me who have decided that they're going to abandon women. Speaking of men specifically, or the same for women. I just, you know, I don't, Kevin. And if you can't imagine it, then you don't have a choice. We'll be there. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. War? How many American men are gay? Are the, you know, the this, just to recap this epiphany that I had reading this article, this Seth Stevens Davidowitz wrote a piece that's in the New York Times yesterday. And yesterday was, day before yesterday, Saturday. And he interviewed this guy who has been living with a woman for 40 years. He's in his 60s. And the guy, just in the last decade, you know, for his entire life, he'd been attracted to men, but he had resisted that impulse. He'd married a woman. He's been married to her for 40 years. He's not going to leave her. He's going to die with her. But he's just realized in the last decade that he really has been gay all this time. He thought that every man was attracted to other men the same way he was, but that they just kind of fought it off. And the men just kind of, you know, gritted their teeth and crawled into bed with a woman, which is what he did all these years, for 40 years. And it suddenly hit me, these guys who come on my program saying it's a choice, from the anti-gay groups and the guys who live obsessed with gay sex, the people like Michelle Bachmann's husband, Marcus Bachmann, are almost certainly gay. And, you know, just so deeply in the closet that they assume that those impulses that they have, that every other man shares with them. And it was like, wow. And how that must lead to just a terrible, terrible, sad, horrible life for so many gay men, because society makes it so difficult, so painful to be out. And therefore, in my mind, you know, the aha for me was two parts. Number one, you know, obviously that, and that, you know, that any man who thinks it's a choice must be able to imagine making that choice, right? Otherwise, why would you firmly assert that it's a choice? And which means you're probably gay. And I'm speaking about men here, because I can't so with so much certainty speak about women, because I'm not a woman. But I, you know, speaking as a man. And secondly, what it says to me is that if somebody, you know, if I had, for example, spent my whole life living with a man because that's what society expected of me, when I really didn't find that all that pleasant. And I'll just, you know, say out loud, as a teenager, I tried having sex with a man and I found it unpleasant. Never did it again. So, you know, does that make me bisexual? No. It means I'm straight. And I figured it out. And I, you know, I mean, there was never in doubt in my mind, but I thought, maybe. But that was back in the 60s. This was when we weren't even having these conversations. I mean, probably 95% of gay men were in the closet at that time. So even, you know, the thinking about it. So anyway, I just find the whole thing fascinating. But it also says to me that we need to be doing everything we can now to help gay people be safe being who they are. Rob in Manhattan. Hey, Rob. Your thoughts? Rob, can you hear me? I'm wondering if we've got a problem with our phone system. I'm going to try another person here. Pam in Vail, Oregon. Hey, Pam, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. So your thoughts on
this? Yeah. You know, I'm wondering if maybe the ones that are saying it's a choice are bisexual. There you go. They like both.
Right.
Anyway, I have a cousin who is gay, has been since he was before he was born, because I believe that it happens in the womb. Just like some people are born little people, you know, some people are born regular size. Maybe we were born wrong. Anybody think of that? The straight people, I mean.
Yeah.
But anyway, I had a little bit of a discussion with my uncle, my cousin's father, because back when he first came out, which was 40 some odd years ago, mm-hmm. his father found him with his partner,
mm-hmm.
and was going to attempt to kill the partner.
Whoa!
And that was a terrible, horrid situation, and my cousin's been with his partner for 40 years, They are very happy together. They're partners in business.
They're gay,
but,
you mean?
Yes, yeah. Very much so.
Yeah.
And my uncle, not too long ago, told me, well, he thinks that that Stephen would have been just perfectly happy if he would have gotten married and had children, and if he would have tried, he would have found that he really liked it. And I said, no, what he would have found was that he didn't like it, and it would have destroyed an entire family, not to mention there's a chance he might have killed himself because of your attitude about it. And I couldn't convince my uncle that it wasn't a choice. It's like...
So maybe your uncle was gay and in the closet.
And that's a possibility, although he's still a dirty old man. But you know, it's like...
Then he's just a bigot. He's just a good old... You know, I mean, it's one or the other. It's people are either just good old-fashioned bigots.
What's funny is he's an old-fashioned Democrat.
Yeah.
He is a Democrat.
Well, that doesn't mean he's not a bigot.
I know, but this is what's so weird. He's not even a Republican, and he's this way.
Yeah.
But I also have a daughter that's gay, which is really funny because she did not even, knowing me, and I'm open-minded about it because I know that it's not a choice.
Yeah.
She still hid it from me until she got married twice. And then finally, second marriage, split up with her husband because she wanted to...
Said enough of this. Pam, thank you for sharing your story. It's thought-provoking. I appreciate it. Thank you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Could China and Japan be provoking World War III? Should we be concerned? Very outrageously ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com. The good. The FIA Formula E Championship. When the racing series opens next year, it'll introduce something new to the world of professional race car driving, sustainable vehicles. That's right, the E in Formula E stands for electric. Every single car used in the Formula E Championship series will run on electricity, not gasoline. Still too early to tell if Formula E will become the next big thing in racing, but one thing is for sure. It certainly has some big-name supporters. My friend Leonardo DiCaprio just announced a partnership with Venturi Automobiles. Now, if all goes according to plan, we'll have his own team in next year's inaugural Formula E series. Switching over to a completely sustainable economy will mean big changes and will force us to use clean energy for things we currently use fossil fuel-created energy for. FIA Formula E Championship Series is an example of what the world will look like if we continue on the path toward a sustainable future. Good on Leonardo for showing his support. The bad. Larry Klayman. Some Republicans are avoiding talking about the death of Nelson Mandela because they don't want to have to answer questions about Ronald Reagan calling the anti-apartheid leader a terrorist. Others, like Freedom Watch's Larry Klayman, are more than willing to talk about Nelson Mandela because they see his death. As they see it, his death gives them another chance to bash President Obama. In his new column for WorldNet Daily, Klayman says that conservatives should, quote, take Mandela's achievement in liberating South Africa from bondage as a further example of what we can accomplish in freeing our own nation from the choking, despotic governmental slavery of Obama, end quote. You know, because trying to expand health care access is totally the same thing as preventing 80% of your country's population from voting, which is what South Africa's white rulers did during apartheid. The lengths some conservatives will go to bash the president are really astounding. And the very, very ugly, the ATF. According to a new report, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has been using mentally disabled people as bait in a number of different operations across the country. In one operation in Wichita, quote, ATF agents referred to a man with a low IQ as slow-headed before deciding to secretly use him as a key cog in their sting. During another operation, agents in Albuquerque, New Mexico, gave a brain-damaged drug addict with little knowledge of weapons a tutorial on machine guns, hoping he could find them one. As if manipulating the disabled wasn't bad enough, ATF agents also reportedly used an attractive female officer to trick teenage boys into buying guns and drugs. There's really no excuse for these kind of tactics. They're just very, very ugly. Remarkable stuff. absolutely remarkable stuff. Well, this is interesting. Jeff in Midvale, Utah. You believe you are bisexual. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Yes. Okay. Just something to chew on. I'm not trying to change anyone's minds or anything, but this is something I kind of reconciled after decades of confusion because I date women. It was great. Then I started dating men. It was great. Go back to women. It was great. And so, you know, I was very confused for a while. Am I gay or am I straight?
Right.
And I finally came, you know, I finally came to the realization that I am bisexual because, like something you said in your show a few minutes ago, you know, if you could feasibly see yourself with a particular sex for the rest of your life, then, you know, you must have that gender preference. And for me, it really lines with both.
Huh. That's interesting.
Hello?
Yeah. Can you hear me? Oh, this is happening more and more. Jeff, can you hear me now?
I can.
Okay. You can hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, good. Because I'm thinking we're having problems with our phone system. I've had a couple of people say they can't hear me. So, that's interesting because I've never met anybody who says that, but I don't doubt it at all. Which way have you ended up, if you don't mind my asking?
I haven't ended up either way. Right now, I'm just kind of floating in the breeze, seeing who might come along. I guess that's a good way to put it.
But, yeah. So your options are twice those of anybody else.
I suppose. And just another note on that is, even in the LGBT community, there's a great deal of discrimination against bisexuals, because as a Savage, whatever his first name is, said a while
Dan.
Back. Dan?
Yeah, Dan Savage.
Okay. He made a statement that, you know, if you think you're bisexual, you're going to end up gay.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was the most bizarre thing.
So from your point of view, Dan is judging everybody by himself. He's gay and he knows he's gay. And I'm judging, and we're just talking, we're men talking about men here. And I'm judging everybody by myself being straight and having no interest in being gay and not having particularly liked it when I once tried it. But there actually is, in your experience, in your own personal experience, there is something in between where you can get an equal amount of pleasure out of being with a man or being with a woman, both emotionally and sexually.
Right, exactly.
Okay, I find that fascinating. Jeff, you are changing my mind. Thank you for the call. Thank you very much.
Sure, thank you for putting me on there.
Sure, I appreciate it. That's very interesting. Jerry in Springfield, Missouri.
Joey?
Joey, I'm sorry. Yes, Joey, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. That was why I was calling in, is that, you know, I've been in the theater for years and know an awful lot of gay people, and I've learned over the years that they've told me, don't confuse the sexual act with the sexual nature. Mm-hmm. And a lot of men or people or couples that I've talked to, when they hear the word gay, all they think about is sex. They don't think about the sexual nature. They don't think these people being able to buy flowers for each other or romanticizing each other or having dinners and, you know, sharing romantic dreams or anything like that. They only think about the sex.
Right.
And because they think sex is a choice, therefore, I conclude that they're thinking homosexuality must be a choice because you're choosing to have sex.
Hmm.
And also, I had the question, do you think...
So, in other words, let me just finish this thread, and then we can move along, Joey. So, you're suggesting that you can know your genuine sexual nature, to use your phrase, by not just who you can have sex with and have pleasure out of it, but who you actually can get romantic about.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Next
point. And I also wondered if it was more difficult for women to come out of the closet than it is for men to come out of the closet, or if it seems more natural to them. And I relate that to the guy who said he's homosexual. I've met other people who claim to be homosexual, and they all seem to be really open, genuinely open to just sex in general with anybody. They just can't imagine it having to...
You mean the guy who said he was bisexual?
Yes, bisexual.
Right.
They can't seem to make, you know... determine or make a distinction between it being different to be with a male than to being with a female.
Well, and apparently that's, you know, there's something to that. And in fact, the point, the statement that he made that for me was the aha that I got today that was as big as the aha I got Saturday when I read this article was when he said, I think that bisexuals out of the LGBT, right, that's the B, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, that bisexuals are among the most discriminated against because, you know, both gays and straights don't believe that there are bisexuals.
Yeah, they think they're faking it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well.
Interesting. I think it's very interesting, but you know, I'm willing to, you know, take Joey on his, or not, not your Joey, to take that last caller on his word on that. So anyhow, thanks a lot for the call. And Mike in Waukegan, Illinois. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Fine.
I think we're learning something about the complexity of human sexuality is what it is.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. You know,
and I'm following this learning curve myself, and I'm very grateful for it.
Really, you know, when I've always liked gals, you know, and I've got one, at least one kid that I hope that's all I've got, you know, and I get turned off by makeup. I can't stand it. I just find it a total turnoff, and I can think of somebody. The complexity can get even more intricate than that. I knew a guy who, you know, he had a girlfriend throughout grade school and in high school, you know, they went together and all this, and but he was extremely jealous of her. You know, he'd get in fights and stuff if anyone would try, you know, he was totally heterosexual, you know, but he'd get in fights with guys if they tried to, you know, come on to her or anything like that, and she left him for that reason.
Right.
And he told me one time, you know, after she'd left him, that he says, when I go out with other gals, I can't even get turned on. I don't know. It's just Joyce is the only gal who can turn me on. Now that is complex, you know.
Well, and I think that and your thing with makeup, and I mean, there are some things that turn me off, and there are, you know, men who are attracted to different parts of the female anatomy, you know, in terms of what arouses them and all these. I mean, I think that there's an enormous level of complexity, and a lot of that has to do probably more with nurture than with nature. But I think that there is some kind of core sexual identity, sexual preference identity, or both identity and preference that we are probably born with. It's a fascinating concept discussion. Mike, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be back with more. Also, I see somebody wants to comment on the Japan-China situation. I'd like to get into that as well. Interesting. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, the Senate is going to have a vote today. Maybe they've already had it on the D.C. Circuit. And the Congress might be getting ready for fast track. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, let's try this again.
Yeah, I think it's my magic jack. Magic jack, I think, is the culprit here. And your other callers who have magic jack have the same problem. I don't think it's your side.
Huh. Okay. All right. So what's up?
Now I'll say over when I'm done, like a walkie-talkie. Over.
Okay. All right. What's up, Johnny? Over?
Yeah. I think I got through my comment about the extreme amount of nuance in gender identity, so I won't go there again. My real reason for calling is about unemployment. I think the way we do is really screwy. My first choice, and I think you agree with this, as Richard Wolff would, is that we need to take the approach the way the Italians do it. But because we've got Republicans running the show, they're just too crazy.
Well, wait, hang on just a second. How do Italians do it?
Concept.
Huh? How do Italians do it?
Well, when you get a choice. If you want to take your unemployment in mass with a bunch of your friends or relatives or neighbors who are unemployed similarly, they get a certain amount of money that they pool and they can open up their business, open up what I call the lateral business instead of the hierarchical business that we have here.
Oh, in other words, you can take a lump sum unemployment?
Huh?
You can take unemployment as a lump sum sort of thing?
Yeah, Richard Wolff explained that in detail. He was on your show, as a matter of fact, as I recall.
Interesting. No, I don't.
Amy Goodman.
Yeah, it must have been Amy Goodman, because I don't. I would. You know, I think I'd remember that, and I don't remember that. So.
Okay. Well, and then the second choice, which I think is probably more reasonable for Republicans, is that instead of cutting people off of unemployment as soon as you have an idea that they've got a job, you continue the unemployment for a period of time into their job. That way you allow for mistakes to happen, like a boss letting them go for whatever reason, so they don't have to reapply and start the trauma all over again.
Right. It also
why we are so penny wise and pound foolish.
Right. It also would allow them to regain some of the lost equity during the time when they were just on unemployment. I mean, typically during when people are just on unemployment, they're maxing out their credit cards. They're not making payments on things that they should be making payments on. They're just paying the interest on their house or whatever, you know. And so if you maintained that unemployment check for the first, you know, 6 weeks or 3 months or whatever of employment, it would allow people to recover some of that, if that makes any sense.
And that's exactly the kind of mindset that we didn't see during Hurricane Katrina. If you recall, when that happened, we had the social welfare agencies giving bending over backwards to extend benefits to foreign nationals from Asia, but to the black folk who were born here, they put them on a constant time clock all the time, constantly threatening them with, oh, you need to reapply. You need to reapply every 30 days. Right. That's economic terrorism.
Yeah. Well, it's it may well be, actually, from the point of view of the people who are being subjected to it. I think that there is an astounding chauvinism on the part of these the Rand Paul folks who believe somehow that unemployment compensation causes unemployment. You know, it's
right. That's the repo way of life.
Yeah.
Have a good day, Tom.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Johnny. Good to hear from you. It really is astounding. I mean, it's talk about mixing up cause and effect. Rand Paul is so confused. He does know about Aqua Buddha, though. Anyhow, we'll be back. It's 10 minutes before you. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, the only animal group that gives you a picture of your goat and the recipient. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on?
Well, President Obama and the other presidents are wending their way to South Africa. They're nearly there, actually, by now. Mm-hmm. And President Obama will deliver remarks at Nelson Mandela's Tuesday memorial service, the White House said today.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't reveal who else would speak, so we don't have any knowledge of that. Also, no bilateral meetings are planned for Obama, and there have been rumors going around that Obama was going to meet with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, and not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Obama's traveling with former President George W. Bush, Laura Bush, and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Hmm. That must be an interesting dinner party.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Hmm.
House and Senate members this afternoon are presenting details of a final defense authorization bill that they're hoping to just zip through both chambers this week, this being the only week that both chambers are in before the end of the year. They are abandoning regular order.
Huh.
They want it signed into law for a 52nd straight year. I think they're embarrassed.
Yeah.
That they didn't get it done by Thanksgiving.
Well, and also, I mean, the Constitution, there's only one thing that the Constitution says: you cannot appropriate money for more than 2 years. And anything else, you can appropriate money 5 years, 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, whatever. But the Army, you cannot appropriate money for more than 2 years. And it's because the founders were so worried about our ever having a military industrial complex or standing army during time of peace. They did not think that there should even be an army during time of peace. And so in Article 1, Section 8, it says that all appropriations for the military can only last for 2 years. So Congress has to. Now, I don't know if this is the end of the 2 year period. It may be that that would be next year, because that's the end of the congressional the end of the Congress.
Right.
It may be that there are some military appropriations that are 2 years old that have to be renewed. I don't know if that's the case.
Right. Well, that may be. I mean, they do this every year. They want to get it done. I mean, they've got military pay raises. They've got all kinds of things. There's death benefits, military construction projects, all kinds of disruptions in military pay, all kinds of things that will just get messed up completely if this doesn't get done. So you've got Republicans, Democrats, both houses, both chambers coming together to propose a way forward to passage. Mm-hmm. So we'll see where that goes. That actually might happen. That won't happen today is the Senate vote on Patricia Millett, who would be the next judge on the D.C. Court of Appeals, D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, because of the bad weather that's been put off until tomorrow morning, although, of course, with Washington, D.C. forecast to be walloped with 4 or 5-plus inches of snow, we'll see whether it happens then also.
Wait a minute. We're supposed to get 4 or 5 inches of snow tomorrow?
Tomorrow's going to be dreadful.
Oh, my. Okay.
Yeah.
Somehow I missed that.
Oh, yes. It's not going to be good. Okay. Meanwhile, not good news for those who wanted to see and thought this was going to be very straightforward. The closing the loophole allowing guns made on 3D printers to escape airport metal detectors and making sure that law stays on the books, saying that, no, you can't get your 3D plastic gun through a metal detector, Mr. Guy. You're not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
It looks as though there's a possibility that this may not get through the Senate after all, and it may get blocked by Republicans. Senators are scheduled to vote at 6 o'clock on a bill to extend the undetectable firearms act.
Now, this is a bill that's been on the books for 20 years.
Right, but there's a fly in the ointment.
Called the NRA?
No, it's called Chuck Grassley.
Yeah, who's probably getting money from the NRA.
Well, he doesn't like the fact that Chuck Schumer is trying to beat today's deadline by seeking unanimous consent to vote on a stronger measure that will require metal parts to be integral and impossible to remove rather than having metal parts that could, in fact, be taken off the gun.
Wow. In other words,
Grassley says that this is the two bills should be debated separately.
Okay. What else is up?
Of course, there's no committee in the Senate anyway, so this could just go completely wrong.
Right.
Well, meanwhile, the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence and the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence say that 8 states took significant steps towards tougher gun control in lieu of congressional action this year, and they're quite pleased about this.
Mm-hmm.
They did give failing grades to more than half the states, but they said that Connecticut, California, Colorado, Delaware, Illinois, Maryland, New Jersey, and New York all enacted major reforms.
Hmm. And is Colorado unique in having the NRA then come in and do recalls on politicians as a consequence of that?
Yeah, I think so.
That's interesting.
I haven't read about any other states where that happened.
Okay.
Meantime, the Supreme Court ruled today that Mitch McConnell and his colleagues can have 15 minutes of oral argument in a case that challenges the constitutionality of President Obama's appointment to the National Labor Relations Board.
Hmm. You're talking about the recess appointments?
This is the recess appointments.
Right.
Wasn't clear whether he would be able to have this extra time. He is going to be allowed to put their particular aspect of the case in there when it's argued on January the 13th. They argued that President Obama usurped congressional power and bypassed the Senate's advising consent responsibilities. And they're going to make those arguments in January when that case comes up.
Mm-hmm. That'll be interesting.
Very interesting. Meanwhile, Secretary of State John Kerry testified tomorrow before the House Foreign Relations Committee about Iran and sanctions and the 6-month interim deal. And in an interview with Time, the Iranian Foreign Minister, Javad Zarif, said, "We do not like to negotiate under duress, and if Congress adapts sanctions, it shows a lack of seriousness and a lack of desire to achieve a resolution on the part of the U.S.
Wow. Wow, remarkable. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goodsfortheoldgood.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. And looking for my... Ah, here it is, my one sheet. It's been an interesting day. Anyway, Professor Harvey Kay is on the line with us, Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay, and author of The Fight for the Four Freedoms, due out in April. But I got to tell you, and I've said this on the air many times, if you want to really read the best history that's ever been written about the founding era, read his book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. It is absolutely brilliant. Harvey Kay, K-A-Y-E, Twitter, at Harvey Kay. That's the website, I guess. So, Professor Harvey Kay, welcome back to the program.
Tom, thank you. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you with us. I was the other day listening to NPR, and they had on this author of this new book, this new history of America, or whatever, this, you know, about I'd like you to characterize how they're characterizing it. It sounded, you know, basically, you know, the guy, the author was on, and he was saying, well, you know, at the founding of America, you had this debate between Thomas Paine and Sir Edmund Burke, and it reflected the two worldviews, you know, and it was, you know, and I thought, wow, this really sounds like an interesting book. But then I read your review and I thought, whoa, wait a minute. So tell us about this.
Okay, well, the young fellow's name is Yuval Levin. He's the rising star of conservative public intellectuals. And I have to say that in one respect, he's a very bright guy. He wrote a really challenging book called The Great Debate, where he tries to lay out, where he does lay out, the ideas of Edmund Burke, the father of modern conservatism, and the ideas of Thomas Paine, the father of modern progressivism. Tries to be somewhat fair along the way, but obviously repeatedly, and he says he, you know, realizes he's going to be that way, repeatedly emphasizes the conservative argument over the progressive argument. And the way he does this is he says, well, look, Burke wasn't the kind of conservative who denied the necessity of change. What he did is he believed in a kind of piecemeal reform, that as change becomes imperative, that you don't oppose it, but if it's part of the culture and the society, and it might enhance people's values or their development of those values, then you can carry out certain reforms. In contrast, he said to Thomas Paine, who, frankly, he doesn't use these words, but it was as if Thomas Paine is completely untethered from reality. You know, that every generation has the right to overthrow that which exists and ignore the sort of legacy of a previous generation. It's this, you know, sort of classic kind of thing. Now, what's interesting about what he does is this, is that he's a conservative of the Burkean variety. Mm-hmm. And the conservative of the Burkean variety never caught on in the United States, really. Right. I mean, it's
Burke was British, first of all. He never came to the United States.
Right. He was British, and he's, you know, he's dealing with the world of England and France, and Burke's influence in America was very limited. Now, there were folks in the United States, the new country, who can be viewed as somewhat Burkean. I'm going to get a lot of arguments from historians, I imagine, when I say this, but, you know, there were those among the Federalists, of like John Adams and others, who had serious reservations about democracy, to the point, actually, of fearing the common people.
Yeah.
And I think, in that sense, they were Burkean. In contrast to Paine, who perhaps, you know, I don't think there's any denying, had an exuberant kind of confidence in the common people, and especially in Americans, in their capacity to make the world over again. Now, by the time I finished the book, which, again, it was rather challenging, I actually felt a little sorry for Levin, because he's laying out a conservative set of ideas, the Burkean set of ideas, which never caught on in America, and which the Republican Party today completely denies. I mean, the Republican Party is not just a reactionary party dominated by the, you know, the likes of the Tea Party folk, but they try to lay claim to the legacy of Thomas Paine in the most fundamental libertarian sense, and that is that, you know, government is a necessary evil, and if you can limit government, do so. So the Tea Party folk, the Republican Party of today, will probably have nothing to do with Yuval Levin's arguments, and will try to lay claim to our hero, Thomas Paine. And I say our hero because for more than 200 years, conservatives did everything they could to bury Paine's memory, or at least to denigrate.
It took Thomas Edison to bring him out of the dustbin of history.
Yeah, no, I mean, over and over again, there were folks who, you know, who grabbed hold of various elements of Paine, his argument for democracy, his argument for separation of church and state, and his argument for creating a social security system, all of which begins with this father of modern progressivism, Thomas Paine. And so if you look about today, well, actually, maybe we should feel sorry for both Levin and for I don't want us to feel sorry for ourselves. I want us to take action. But our Democratic Party is not the party of Thomas Paine. The Republican Party is clearly not the party of Burke. And then that's,
right.
So, you know, I mean, there's reason for us to, as I say in the article, to take him out for a beer, Yuval Levin, you know, sympathize with him, and then go home and take action.
Right, and help the Democratic Party become the party of Thomas.
Oh, no, absolutely. They definitely, without question.
Well, I'm not sure that the Republican, as you said, Burkean, you know, has never caught on in the United States. I think that there was an attempt, and it's the reason why Russell Kirk back in 51 or 52 or 53, when he wrote The Conservative Mind, you know, the entire first chapter is devoted to Sir Edmund Burke.
Right, right. There are those figures, and Russell Kirk is the prime example of someone who really did worship Burke's memory. But William F. Buckley, of course, when he created the magazine National Review, he brings together what he hopes to be the Burkean side and the Adam Smith side of conservatism, if you like,
right.
The sort of traditionalists and the, you know, the sort of the pro-marketeers. So.
Right. Yeah, but it never quite worked out. But it's fascinating. And by the way, I got your Twitter wrong. It's Harvey J.K., H-A-R-V-E-Y, the letter J, K-A-Y-E is your
Thank
Twitter.
Thank you. That's very nice. I hate to correct people. So
oh, no, you should. If you're ever on the air and you're misintroduced, please, especially by me, but by anybody. Don't you know, hosts don't feel bad being.
Yeah, I'm laughing to myself right now. I had my students meet in my class 15 minutes early so I could come to talk to you, and I think they said they were going to possibly listen on a laptop. And when I just said I hate to correct people, I know they're saying, that isn't the Harvey K. we know.
So, okay, so in the minute and a half or so we have left, we're talking with Harvey K., professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, and author of the absolutely brilliant book Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. And he has a new book coming out, The Fight for the Four Freedoms. We will have you on when that book comes out again. Professor K., what, you know, the Tea Party and these guys who call themselves conservatives, like Ted Cruz, these guys are really reactionaries. They're not conservatives. Who are the real conservatives? What has happened to the conservatives?
The conservatives have all but disappeared, or they're being primaried, right, by the likes of the Tea Party folks.
Right.
You know, I look around, and maybe you can tell me, I don't see any conservatives in the grand tradition.
I think Olympia Snow was the last one.
You know what? That's well said, actually, from Maine. Absolutely.
I mean, you've got the neoconservatives. You've got the Lindsey Grahams and the John McCains, but
right.
They're not
right.
Really conservatives.
No, they're definitely not conservatives. But, of course, I mean, again, The Tea Party folks have done a remarkable job of literally mastering the Republican Party, holding them to account and affording them a sense of direction. And the tragedy for us is that they've been very aggressively laying claim to Thomas Paine, whose legacy has served generations of liberals and radicals and progressives to advance.
Well, it also serves revolutionaries, though, and these guys are revolutionary.
The likes of the Tea Party.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Libertarian revolutionaries are very close to that. They're prepared to, like, you know, to tear the whole house down.
That's right. Overthrow the old order.
Yeah.
And throw the baby out with the bathwater. In fact, according to Right Wing Watch, Freedom Works it's a whole long story. I can't get into it now. Anyhow, Harvey J. K. is his Twitter address. Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you, Tom. I hope to talk to you soon.
Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Harvey K., his book, The Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. If you have never read this book, you must. If you want to know the history of the American Revolution, read it. Thank you, Harvey. And welcome back. Let's see. Pierre in Hartselle, Colorado. Hey, Pierre, welcome to the program. Thank you for watching Free Speech TV.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind today?
I wanted to talk about the deal, whether it's choice or not, when you're gay, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was a prostitute. And so I grew up around a lot of gay people because they were outcasts. But the one thing that I always laughed about was that so many of the women that she hooked with, basically they turned gay later on. They got so fed up with men, they actually made the choice.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, you know, and I always laugh because, well, how men are in general. And I think to myself, well, if there's any reason that anyone turns gay, I know for a fact there's a lot of female prostitutes that do it. So
yeah, because
anyway.
They've seen the worst side of male sexuality.
That's right, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so that's the only time I would say it was ever a choice. And even then, it's probably more subconscious than anything else. So, but that's it.
That's fascinating. Pierre, thank you for sharing your story with us, and thank you for calling. I much appreciate it. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. I just wanted to address the gay issue. I really don't care whether a person's gay or not, but you said once that the people that believe that the Earth is only 6,000 years old, you know, they believe that we have it right. We know everything, which has got to stem from the Bible. So to me, ignoring science is a form of brainwashing. How much do you think the Bible or other religions, because they have a book, brainwashes people into living such sad, unhappy lives for the rest of their life for the sake of putting up the front of being a proper religious follower?
Well, I think it happens to some people. What's the point? What's the point you're trying to make?
Well, again, I just think that a lot of these people who hide in the closet, it's because they live in communities. You know, their parents are heavily Christian, whatever, you know. And
This is the essence of this article by Seth Stevens Davowitz that's in the New York Times on Saturday, titled How Many American Men Are Gay, is that when you look at the red states, you find,
right.
You know, 1% of men on Facebook say that they are interested in men. When you look at blue states, it's 3%, and it's not because gay people are moving to the blue states, because the same percentage holds true with teenagers, and they're not physically mobile the way that adults are. So,
I agree. Just one last thing is just, and I know the Old Testament and the New Testament are two totally different books, because in the Old Testament, it's an abomination. And as I think you said once, that Jesus never really spoke about it.
No, and in fact, if you read the story of the Last Supper, you kind of get the idea that maybe Jesus and John were a little more friendly than the average, you know, because John is resting with his head on Jesus's chest. And, you know, they say John, the disciple who Jesus loved, said, and that kind of thing, you know, and I thought he loved them all, you know, but John apparently was physically special. So who knows? I mean, you know, it's an interesting read, that book. Michael, thank you very much for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, a lot of the news. This, as I was bumping out with Harvey and, you know, we've got a hard clock here on the show. I can't say, give me another 20 seconds. No, sorry. Boing, off you go. Because our show is simulcast as radio and television, and we're doing profit and nonprofit and all these things. It's got to be the way it's got to be. But this Liberal Planet published this article today. Speaking to the Akron, Ohio Beacon Journal, an executive with the Koch brothers-funded FreedomWorks group said the Tea Party needs to overthrow the old guard Republican and take over. Adam Brandon, who serves as the group's executive vice president, told the paper that forming a third party isn't the path the Tea Party should follow. He said, I would rather take over the GOP. I see the next several years a battle for control of the Republican Party, of the GOP. This is amazing. I mean, the Tea Party was founded back in the 1980s by tobacco lobbyists and by the tobacco industry as a smoker's rights group. And it never really caught fire. But many of the same scientists who were denying that tobacco caused cancer are now calling themselves Tea Partiers and denying that global warming is happening. Much of this is being funded by the Koch brothers, who, of course, make much of their money. I mean, Georgia-Pacific is one of their largest brands, I suppose, but make a lot of their money through Koch's petroleum industry. They will make billions if the Keystone Pipeline is completed. Billions, hundreds of, perhaps over as much as $100 billion. It's pretty amazing. And so they create this thing, FreedomWorks, and it's, you know, it's a... which brings about this modern Tea Party. Very, very interesting. Anyhow, Rob in New York City. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. I tried to get you before, but my cell phone cut you off, so I'm on a speakerphone now, my landline. I'm sorry.
That's quite all right.
Tom, I just wanted to tell you that, number one, you know, I am born a gay man.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, I had one or two experiences with women,
mm-hmm.
where, like you, except you had one experience with a man, I found it rather repulsive and never did it again.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, years ago, I used to think bisexuals were not bisexuals. They were just, you know, in the closet, and they just told you one thing, and they really were homosexual.
Right.
I have changed my mind. I believe now that there are bisexual men in this world that were born this way.
Yeah. Well, there was, you know, we had a caller earlier who I think was being quite candid. And
I heard him. Remember, on 13th Street, there's the LGBT community center, and the B stands for bisexual.
Right.
And it's true, bisexuals were discriminated to a certain degree, but that's because there's a confusion between the people that are really in the closet and the people that might be born that way.
Yep.
There's so many complexities and nuances to sexuality, so that's understandable.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
But basically, I've kind of changed my mind about it, and I have to tell you now, I just dislike Marcus Bachmann and Michelle Bachmann, obviously, for certain reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have met effeminate heterosexual men.
Mm-hmm.
And Marcus Bachmann, doubt up, protest too much, maybe. But, yeah. You know, he could be just one of those effeminate heterosexual men that...
he could be, but why would he choose to spend his life, his full-time work, working with gay men?
Well, he considers it an ex-gay therapy. It's a stupid ex-gay therapy.
I understand that. You know, setting aside the, you know, the damage that that kind of so-called therapy does, it just seems like, you know, a guy who says, you know, it's like the question I remember when I was in college wondering, you know, one of my roommates at one point was, and who's still a very good friend, was in the medical school at Michigan State, the osteopathy school. He was getting his, you know, becoming a doctor. He became a urologist. And or a surgeon, you know, he cuts up people's kidneys. He just recently retired, and he once made the comment to me. He says, "You know, I sometimes wonder about these guys who decide to become gynecologists," and that got me scratching my head and thinking about it. You know, why do people make the life choices, the career choices they make? And you know,
but anyway, I wanted to tell you one other thing before you know we get cut off somehow
sure.
again. But I. New York City, you would not believe how many closeted gay men there are. Believe it or not.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I've been going with this guy since June, and I just found out recently he's married to a woman.
My. Oh, my. See, this.
And again, it's one of those things, you know, he could be born a bisexual or he's a closet case and just won't admit it. There are some men, you know, that sleep with women and they have sex with them and they're still really gay.
Yeah.
So there's so many nuances to this. It's just unbelievable. You
yeah.
know?
I think I you know, it's I agree. And I think that your point and the fellow who called earlier, that was so poignant, you know, where he said that he was bisexual and that he felt that the bisexuals were the most discriminated against. I know somebody who's transgendered, and I would argue that the transgendered are the most discriminated against. At least the greatest amount of violence is directed toward them. But anyhow, Rob, thank you for your call. It's nice to hear from you, and thank you for your thoughts on this. Joanne, we have just a minute to the break. Joanne in Clifton, New Jersey, you wanted to disagree with something I said?
Well, I was disagreeing before when you said bisexuals don't exist, and you've clearly seen the light. And that's what I was calling to talk to you about, because I've known quite a few bisexual men and a lot of gay men in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is definitely true about the discrimination, because most of the gay men I've ever known all consider that everyone who says they're bisexual means they're in the closet. But I had a man explain it to me this way. He said that, you know, when you're straight or gay, you're not attracted to every single person you meet. And a bisexual is like that, too. They are attracted to some men and some women.
Mm.
And at some point in their life, when they meet the person that they want to spend their life with, they make a decision as to who to spend their life with. But it doesn't make them straight or gay. It just happens
right.
to be the person that they're with at the moment.
Right. That makes perfect sense. Joanne, thank you for sharing that. Thank you for that insight. I think I am getting more liberal as time goes on, or at least more informed. 28 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And as I said, I've been, you know, discussing this and debating this for 10 years on this program with people, and still learning. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is very interesting. Howard in New York City. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Yeah, hi. I just turned you on. You're talking about gays and lesbians. My grandfather's brother was a doctor, and he was gay. My mother's sister never admitted she was gay, but she slept in a bed with a woman to get in that double bed, you know, a king bed or whatever, her whole life. My son is gay. And my sister is gay, and she's bisexual. So take all that as you want. I mean, when people say you can learn this, learn that, you know, five generations.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's genetic passed down from generation to generation.
Oh, I think it's just human. I mean, you know, you see gay behavior in, or that you find gays in, and bisexuality in animals. I mean, right across the species, you know, different. I think this is just part of, you know, being biologically an animal. I mean, you know, here we are.
The thing about my sister, which is she was married to a doctor who was nice, but he was a little bit strident in
mm-hmm.
the way he spoke. And so they got a divorce, and she stayed and now with a woman for many, many years,
mm-hmm.
Who was also nice but gentle. And I asked her, is that a sexual thing? She said, no, it's just that one is nice and gentle, the other is nice and strident. So she just switched.
So, interesting
information for you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think probably all of us have stories like that to tell. And I, you know, my grandfather's was one of five boys, and one of them, my uncle Sig, was gay. And you know, I didn't figure it out until I was a teenager. But you know, Sig had lived with Rudy for 30 years at the time that I was little, and they died within a year or so of each other, a couple of years of each other, and they lived down in San Antonio and ran an antique shop. And he was one of my favorite uncles. I mean, it was just your granduncle, I guess he would be. And so in any case, enough of my stories. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois, you have a theory.
But yeah, Tom, and thank you so much for taking my call. I think that just some people fall in love with people. I think sometimes people find their life partners and decide that love is unconditional and transcends, everything. I think after a while, I don't think physical love means all that much, especially after you're married for a very, very long time.
I think that people who've been married for a very long time can still have a good sexual relationship. But secondly, I think that what you're saying might be true for somebody who's genuinely bisexual. But for somebody who is just absolutely definitely gay or absolutely definitely straight, that's probably not the case. I mean, there are men that I love, but I don't love them sexually, I love as friends and have throughout my life, that I would go to the wall for, I'd fight for, I would die for, but not that I would want to sleep with. Am I making sense?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I just have known some people, and sometimes you just meet that one person, be it whoever, and then that's who you're, most connected with.
Yeah. Well, that would be a statement that I think somebody who's a true bisexual would say, and that the person's gender wouldn't matter. Marty, thanks for the call. Kathy in Valparaiso, Indiana, you have some thoughts on this?
Hi, Tom. Yes, this morning at 8 o'clock, I flipped on the TV set and it just said movie, and I was going about my business, and then I stopped because it talked about water pollution and the fact that frogs and fish that are born male are changing sexes now.
Yeah, in part because of the pollution. Now, that's pollution caused by estrogen mimicking chemicals.
Right. And I have a bisexual child, and well, he's a grown man now, but the fact is, and there was one more thing before I forget. Back in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a medical study done that if a pregnant woman got the flu in her third trimester, it could cause the child to become gay.
No, that's schizophrenia.
Schizophrenia. Okay, I'm sorry.
And that's a whole different thing.
But right.
And it was the first trimester.
I just find it fascinating that you're discussing this when it came on this morning, and I think it's coming back on this afternoon. It just said movie.
Yeah, but see, I don't think that being gay is an anomaly. I don't think that it's caused by pollution. It's there may be that. For example, we're seeing girls and boys hitting puberty on average 2 years earlier right now than they did 30 years ago. Whereas, that age of menarche, I think is what it's called for girls, and puberty, I guess. No, puberty for girls and boys. That remains constant for, presumably thousands of years. And then, in the last 30 years, that's changed. That, I think, is the result of these estrogen-mimicking chemicals and actual estrogens, in being pumped into our beef supply and things like that. But I'd be very surprised if, because the percentage of gay, folks who are gay have just always been with us. I mean, it's just been always there. Kathy, thank you for the call. Thomas in Parrish, Florida, you wanted to talk about the Swiss and the minimum wage.
Well, yeah, hopefully this is a subject everyone likes, no matter what their persuasion is. Mm-hmm. But earlier you were talking about, Thomas Paine, Thomas Edison, Thomas Jefferson. Your name's Tom. My name's Thomas. So I feel like there's a lot of Thomases here. But, I was trying to put it in a sense where it wouldn't violate, libertarian so-called principles, where even a libertarian would think that's a good idea. I think you're
The minimum wage.
Well, even beyond the minimum wage, in Switzerland right now, I think you had interviewed someone where they're proposing a law where everyone in the entire country gets a minimum.
It's minimum income.
And a minimum income, that's it. And so...
Whether you work or not.
Whether you work or not, and so you might say, where are you going to find jobs for janitors and stuff like that? Well, they'll just have to increase, how much that job actually pays, because this is just the bare minimum, and people wouldn't want to just live off that, but at least they would have it. And so the question is, where does money come from? And by the way, it's great to talk to you. It's the first time I've called in. I've listened to your show for years. But the Federal Reserve creates the money. The banks create it by giving out loans. So every dollar that's supposedly created, as I understand it, is created with debt.
That's correct.
And then, so this would be just the opposite. It would be from the ground up. So if, like, let's say I got $20,000, and it's kind of like the Italian thing that people were, someone called in about earlier, where you get all your unemployment all at once. Now, if I get that $20,000 from the government to start my own job, you could call it like an entrepreneurial stimulus. So this would be kind of conservative. So
see, this is what I think the Small Business Administration should be doing.
Yeah.
Is they should be juicing small businesses. They should be giving $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 loans, you know, $200,000 loans to people who want to start, you know, the local clothing store or the local dry cleaner or the, you know, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. I mean,
you should give it to everybody. And if I failed at a business, at least it's going to trickle up because, I mean, let's say I try to start a candle making business and I completely fail at it. All the money that I spend is going to go to other people anyways.
Yeah, it's all, it all goes into the economy. Yeah, I'm absolutely with you. I'm totally with you, Thomas. Excellent point. Thank you for the call. Marty in Encinitas, California. Hey, Marty.
Yes, hi. You know, being on hold is so much fun. This is great. You should get college credit just for being on hold for your show.
Because you get to hear so many different opinions on different topics.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. I have a whole bunch of college degrees, but I have been enrolled in Tom Hartman University now for almost 3 years. And I've seen you talk about your new book about 2016. I have not read it yet. Mm-hmm. But between you and Oliver Stone, this historical perspective is really helping give me a great context on my own personal experience. And I have a comment, sort of personal, sociological, historical comment on sexuality.
Okay.
Which I hadn't really planned on until I tuned in and that was the topic. Born in 1950, I was taught heterosexuality. There was no birth control, as you pointed out in your talk. I saw you talk at the Commonwealth Club about your new book.
Okay.
There was no birth control. We knew who the Catholic people were on the street because they had tons of kids.
Mm-hmm.
By the 1960s, we had birth control. I personally became fascinated by lesbian literature. My mom was she was okay with the fact that I loved to read. And these are all just things that were going on. In 1971, as you pointed out as well, that kind of was a wake-up call because when you said everybody was kind of acting out and going crazy, that was true. And sexually, that was true as well.
Mm-hmm.
Movies like Deep Throat, you know, I looked at Deep Throat as, gee, is this a training film? You
mm-hmm.
know, because everyone was just pushing the boundaries.
Yeah, that was the one and only porn film that Louise and I have ever gone to see, and we did that right after the Supreme Court ruled on it because we were just so curious. You know, it's like
yes, and I applaud Harry Reams for going to court.
Yeah,
for going to court on that.
But we're running out of time here, Marty.
Okay.
Quick, 10 seconds. Summary.
Yeah, by the 1980s, diagnostic interviewing, I was saying, when did you first have your first sexual experience with a man and a woman?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, did you ever have?
Ah. Uh-huh.
And I had one last point, that women still have to use sex in some cases for urban survival. And I don't mean that as prostitutes. I mean I have heard women just in basic situations.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Marty, I'm sorry we're out of time, but I understand what you're saying. Thank you for the call, and I think all our listeners and viewers do too. We'll be back. Welcome back. Frank, watching Free Speech TV in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Hi, I want to talk about the homosexual thing.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a neighborhood of lower middle class. There was a woman who was we call them dykes, brought up a woman, and there were a lot of homosexual men around. Not a lot, but, you know, two or three.
Mm-hmm. You realize that's a fairly offensive term these days.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm bringing it up because that's the terms we used.
Yeah. Well, let's try not to use it on the air again, okay?
All right.
Thank you.
But the point I'm trying to make is that when I grew up and we lived with these people, it was none of our business what they, who they were, what they did.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point that I think people miss about homosexuality. You don't walk up to somebody and say, "Are you straight?" You know, you just don't do that. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. Frank, thank you for your call. You're pushing the boundaries here of what I think is appropriate to talk, to say on television, so I'm going to move along. Patricia in Ettrick, Wisconsin. Hey, Patricia, what's up?
Hello, Tommy boy. We are astonished, amazed, and impressed by your very knowledgeable brain.
Uh-oh.
And we love it when you nail some of these right-wingers with all that knowledge you have.
Well, thank you, Patricia. Is there a but coming? But!
Yeah. No.
Okay.
I was going to talk about homosexuality and so forth, and my sister is gay, and she came out and told us when she was about 14, and there were 7 kids in my family and my parents, and she was totally 100% accepted.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
I don't think my dad ever quite understood it, but, you know, it was okay. But she had a hell of a time in high school.
Mm.
However, I have a license to practice behavioral counseling, and I had one of the top 10 professors in the United States, and we talked about homosexuality and so forth, and one of the things he brought up was back in the Roman times of Caesar, Julius Caesar, for instance, was what he brought up, was they could be married, but to have adultery would be an execution. So when Caesar was on some of his campaigns, he would take several young boys or men with him to take care of his needs, and that was acceptable. Mm. But if he had a woman, he could be killed, and the same was true for his wife. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
So gay sex was not considered infidelity.
Right.
Interesting. Very interesting. Patricia, thank you for that. I can't verify the factual accuracy of it, but and who knows what, you know, what has come down from the Roman Empire that may be lore and may be fact, but it's interesting. We'll be back 10 minutes before that. Here with you. Oh, this is interesting. These two calls back to back are going to be fascinating. NJ in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, NJ, what's on your mind?
Professor Hartman.
Yes, sir.
I am older than you. And all my years on this earth, I have never seen or heard of a homosexual or a lesbian animals. And I think we're, if I'm wrong with this one, you can correct me.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of speaking, animals are the same as human beings, isn't it?
NJ, hold that thought, and I'm going to bring in Robert from Great Court, South Carolina. And
yes.
Robert, you grew up on a farm.
Yes.
And NJ is still on the line with us, so it's the three of us talking now. What did you observe growing up on a farm?
Homosexuality in swine and poultry. I have seen turkeys displayed as though they were males.
I'm also a country boy. I'm not a city boy, although wherever I've lived around the world, it's always been a city. But I am a country boy. My father was a farmer, raised a lot of animals.
So, NJ, you're saying as a farmer you never saw this, and Robert, you're saying that you saw turkeys, male turkeys, preening for others, and
female,
your own animals.
You know, my brother, excuse me to say this, but I would have to see that for myself to believe you.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll leave it at that. Both of you, thank you so much for the call, and
thank you
for sharing your experiences. See, I mean, this is the variety of human experience, the variety of human, you know. Anyhow, Jay in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Jay.
Hi, Tom. I'm speaking only from personal experience, but I'm in my 70s, so I have some time on this.
Mm-hmm.
As a kid, I never knew what the next crush would be. It might be an athletic girl. It might be a young man. My movie idols were, when people talked about having a type, I had no type.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's also my thought that your emphasis changes as you in different periods of your life. When I was in my mid-20s and I was desperate to have a child, I thought my husband was just the most wonderful thing that ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky enough to produce some wonderful kids out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to give you if a group of us are watching a parade, the straight guys are going to, their eyes are going to follow the majorettes.
Sure.
And the straight women will probably, you know, look at a certain kind of man that pleases them. I never know who I'd, but I'm going to follow a trombone player. It never, gender was
so,
never
so you're, an issue. You're one of those folks who are actually bisexual.
I thought I chose to be straight in my 20s because it was easier. It's an easier life. I got married. I had kids. It was easier.
Sure.
And one day I'm watching a group of carpenters doing a job, and I noticed that my focus, where my eyes have stopped, is on a very, very attractive female carpenter. And I remember, you know, my snide saying, oh, yeah, you're really straight, right? And so apparently I didn't either crystallize in either camp. And I remember my daughter at one point when she was little, and she said, Mom, someday you'll meet a nice man or woman and settle down. And she was wrong, because I'm alone and I'm very happy alone. But I think there are people who for whatever reason their emphasis changes. Said it earlier, you fall over with a person and not a body type or a gender.
Right.
And I think there are people like me who do that. So.
Remarkable. Jay, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Hey, thanks.
You're welcome. It's very, very, it's a fascinating perspective. Keith in Bentonville, Arkansas, the home of Walmart. Holy cow. Keith, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Nice to hear from you. Or talk to you. It's kind of a lifeline progressive radio is to us down in the South that don't have any outlet that we can really, other than like free speech TV or something, but
right.
the radio is our only contact with sanity, sometimes it seems. Hey, I wanted to talk about sexual preference, and if you really tap into something. I kind of had an aha moment the same way you did, or, you know, whenever you said that, that was a different way of thinking about it. Something that I had thought about before was conservatives have a lack of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
They have a really hard time putting themselves in somebody else's place and seeing the world through their eyes.
I think, let me rephrase that, because I think that what really is going on is that, you know, sociopaths are people who are not capable of empathy. They're people who view everybody else as an object to be used for their own pleasure. And, right. And therefore, I think sociopaths would be very, very drawn to conservative philosophy. And so they're probably overrepresented among conservatives. Whereas people who are highly empathic, people who feel other people's feelings, who have a lot of empathy, they're more likely to be and overrepresented among liberals and progressives. But that doesn't mean that all conservatives are sociopaths or are incapable of experiencing empathy. Does that make sense?
No. Yes. Yes, it does.
And it doesn't mean that all liberals are bleeding heart liberals.
Exactly. But you're born with a predisposition to be gay, and at the same time, you're born with a predisposition to be have a lack of empathy.
I agree.
Then you're going to imagine that everybody else is like you. And that's what you were talking about early on in your show.
Yeah. Yeah. When the penny dropped for me, when this article by Seth Stevens Davidowitz, where this fellow told him, who is in his 60s, who had been married to a woman for 40 years, still is, had no plans to leave her, said that he had always assumed that every man was attracted to other men just like he was. And he has this sexless relationship. But, you know, hey, he's invested 40 years in it. Keith, thanks for the call. It's a fascinating article. How many American men are gay? In Saturday's New York Times. We will be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with us today. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Ain't a spectator sport. You got to show up. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.